cultural skills, as well as all-around military expertise. Other organizations within the SOF community bring their own unique skills to the table, including, not coincidentally, skills related to the operation of armed drones. Put all these skills together and you have a group of military personnel with precisely the skills needed for the long war. No surprise, then, that both the Bush and Obama administrations have come to rely heavily on special operations forces. Army Special Forces worked closely with CIA officers to help Afghanistan's Northern Alliance defeat the Taliban in the fall of 2001. And SEALs, again in close coordination with the CIA, played a crucial role during Operation Anaconda. Since those early post-9/11 days, Special Operations Forces have played an ever larger role in an expanding number of countries. SOF personnel embedded in over a dozen U.S. embassies conduct counterterrorism-related information operations, and SOF personnel embedded with foreign militaries continue to serve as trainers and advisors. Special operators can offer quiet assistance to foreign governments interested in capturing or killing terrorists in their territory, and, if necessary, they can take direct action themselves. As a result, they have increasingly been relied upon to capture or kill suspected terrorists outside of hot battlefields, both through quick cross-border raids and through the use of drone strikes. Much of the time, their precise role is, of necessity, kept secret. Foreign governments may want U.S. military help, but only if they can deny any American role. And when military operations raise difficult questions about sovereignty, keeping them secret is often less diplomatically embarrassing for all concerned. Still, other military activities rely on secrecy even more directly. For instance, some foreign information operations may be ineffective if everyone knows that a particular radio show or television program is U.S. funded. Of course, engaging in covert activities has traditionally been an intelligence community job, not a military job. The CIA and other intelligence agencies must report to the House and Senate Select Committees on Intelligence, but the military reports to the Armed Services Committees, and both the Pentagon and the Armed Services Committees have a strong aversion to letting the intelligence committees horn in on their territory. Regardless of who's doing what, all activity designated as covert requires a presidential finding and subsequent notification of the intelligence committee, even if just the so-called Gang of Eight. The Senate and House majority and minority leaders, and the chairs and ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. This gives the Pentagon a strong incentive to insist that whatever it is that Special Operations Forces are doing, they're not engaging in covert activities. Conveniently, the Intelligence Authorization Act, which lays out most of the rules for covert activities, exempts traditional military activities from its definition of covert action, though the definition and scope of traditional military activities remains hotly contested. In practice, military and CIA personnel generally work together quite closely when planning and engaging in drone strikes or raids. CIA and other intelligence agency personnel play a vital role in providing targeting information to military teams planning strikes, and military personnel are often detailed to assist with intelligence agency activities. But the increasing fuzziness of the line between the intelligence community and the military creates confusion and uncertainty. Who decides which agency should take the lead and on what basis? How are activities coordinated? What's the chain of command? What law governs each entity's activities? Does the CIA use the same targeting rules as the military? Does covert military activity risk depriving the military personnel involved of protection under the Geneva Conventions? No one's saying. The blurred lines also create a risk of forum shopping, tempting the executive branch to place a given targeted strike under the direction and control of whichever entity is deemed to have the most accommodating congressional overseers. Give the CIA the formal lead on a particular operation, and it need only be reported to the intelligence committees. Give DOD the formal lead, and depending on the type of operation, it may be reported to the Armed Services Committees, or not reported to anyone in Congress at all. All this also creates a strange irony. As the United States continues to expand its use of lethal force overseas, the CIA is fighting to insist that its alleged drone strikes are and must remain covert. At the same time, the Pentagon is fighting to insist that its secret special operations missions should not be categorized as covert action. In both cases, the intent, or at least the result, is to shield the activities at issue from scrutiny. The CIA wants to keep journalists and the ACLU off its back. The military mostly just wants the intelligence committees to leave it alone. The end result is the same. When the covert goes semi-overt, and the overt goes semi-covert, the public is left in the dark. Just to add to the blurriness and complexity, many of the participants in America's secret war are neither military personnel nor CIA paramilitary officers, but private contractors. And the presence of contractors in the mix makes it even harder to decide if what we're looking at is war or something else, and makes it difficult to know how to apply the law of armed conflict. Is a contractor who provides intelligence analysis that supports targeting decisions a combatant? A civilian participating in hostilities? Can he or she be lawfully targeted by U.S. adversaries? What rights and duties do contractors have? The U.S. government's increasing reliance on private military and security contractors has been well documented, but it remains extremely difficult to get precise and detailed information about the number of contractors, the cost of contracted services, the specific functions contractors perform, and their fates. During the first Gulf War, fewer than 10,000 civilian contractors accompanied some 500,000 military personnel. During the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, contractors outnumbered U.S. troops, and they paid heavily. Some estimates suggest that more contractors than troops were killed in those wars. That's classified. Why are most of the details about U.S.-targeted counterterrorism strikes, whether they involve military service members, paramilitary intelligence personnel, or paramilitary private contractors acting at the behest of the government, kept in the secret world? I'll return to this subject later. But for now, it's worth noting that the U.S. government has a long history of overclassifying information that shouldn't be classified at all, and keeping information classified until long after any justification for classifying it has disappeared. My first government job was at the State Department during the waning days of Bill Clinton's second administration. During that period, I recall reading top-secret memo after top-secret memo, all signed by the same senior colleague, all dealing with a particular issue. I'd tell you what the issue was, but then, as we say, I'd have to kill you. Believe me, that's not because revealing it would do the slightest damage to national security. I'm keeping mum for one reason only. Long ago, I signed a large number of terrifying forms swearing to donate my firstborn child to the Justice Department if ever I should reveal the contents of a classified document. Aside from that, there's no reason for secrecy. Suffice it to say that those memos I remember from my time at the State Department contained absolutely no information worthy of a top-secret designation. But I was young and inexperienced, so at the time I assumed I must be missing something. I finally worked up the courage to ask my senior colleague directly, "Why," I wondered tentatively, "are all these memos classified top-secret? Is this issue more sensitive than meets the eye?" His response was brisk and unapologetic. "No, not really. But if I don't put top secret on my memos, people will think they're not important, and no one will bother to read them." Since then, I've seen the same phenomenon over and over. To mix metaphors, classified information is the currency of the realm inside the national security sausage-making machine. It's the only way to be special. You don't have a security clearance? You're no one. You only have a secret-level clearance? I'm sorry, a top-secret clearance is required for you to be part of this meeting. You have a top-secret clearance? Regrettably, this document is part of a compartmented code word special access program, and you're not read in. In fact, it's part of a waived, unacknowledged special access program that only I and four other people can know about. Sorry about that. As the national security bureaucracy has expanded and more classified documents are produced, more and more people need security clearances in order to do their jobs. But as more and more people receive security clearances, the iron law of supply and demand kicks in, and the value of clearances goes down. According to an excellent 2010 Washington Post series on Top Secret America, an estimated 854,000 people hold top secret clearances. That's not a very exclusive club. Any secret that can be accessed by 854,000 people isn't much of a secret. Throw in the people with lower-level clearances, and we get up to more than 4 million, or nearly 2% of the adult population of the United States. Who let all those people into the club? As a result, the government keeps finding new ways to distinguish between levels and types of access. And more documents and programs are reflexively given a high classification, even when there's really no secret to keep. The government's Information Security Oversight Office reported that 92 million decisions to classify information were made in 2011 alone, representing a 20% increase in classification decisions from 2010 and a 40% increase from 2009. And as I said, this problem isn't new. A 2011 report by the Brennan Center for Justice offers some choice glimpses into history. By 1956, only a decade and a half after an executive order signed by Franklin Roosevelt launched the modern classification system, a DOD panel was already warning that overclassification has reached serious proportions. In 1970, a Defense Science Board task force reported that the volume of scientific and technical information that is classified could profitably be decreased by perhaps as much as 90%. In 1985, yet another DOD committee concluded that too much information appears to be classified. In 1994, a joint CIA-DOD commission found that the classification system has grown out of control. Fast forward to the 9/11 Commission's report, which was every bit as damning. Current security requirements nurture overclassification and excessive compartmentation of information among agencies. Even more recently, the congressionally established Public Interest Declassification Board, PIDB, concluded in a November 2012 report, "The system is compromised by overclassification and, not coincidentally, by increasing instances of unauthorized disclosures." Documents overclassified by government employees range from the embarrassing and illegal to the merely goofy. According to the Brennan Center report, FBI efforts to completely discredit Martin Luther King Jr. as the leader of the Negro people were classified, as were government radiation experiments involving human subjects. Ditto, oddly, a 1940s Navy study on sharks attacking human beings. A 2003 report by the National Security Archive notes that during a 1999 declassification review, a CIA employee even redacted a portion of a tongue-in-cheek 1974 memo dealing with a fictitious effort by an organization of uncertain makeup under the name of Group of the Martyr Ebenezer Scrooge to sabotage the annual courier flight of the government of the North Pole. Prime Minister and Chief Courier S. Claus has been notified. Closely linked to the problem of overclassification is the failure of government officials to declassify documents when the need for secrecy is over. In theory, most classified documents are classified for 10 years or less, after which they are automatically declassified. Under a Clinton-era executive order, those exceptional documents classified for longer periods must be automatically declassified after 25 years. But as report after report has demonstrated, automatic declassification is usually anything but. Agencies can review documents subject to automatic declassification to ensure that they don't fall into any exceptions to declassification, and agencies lack the authority to declassify information initially classified by other agencies. As a result, the automatic declassification process can take years. In the era of electronic information, documents of all kinds have proliferated, worsening the backload still more. Ironically, our government's tendency to overclassify information and the sheer complexity of the rules for dealing with classified information ends up increasing the number of cases involving the mishandling or unauthorized disclosure of classified information. Those with security clearances are obligated to abide by a confusing, arbitrary, and ridiculously cumbersome set of rules to safeguard classified material. But the rules are so incoherent that even the most conscientious employees tend to fall afoul of them at one time or another. Find someone you know who has a security clearance and ask him or her the following questions. Can you swear that you never discussed classified information outside of a sensitive, compartmented information facility? Or never, ever wandered out of a meeting held at a classified level with some notes you really shouldn't have taken jotted down on your totally unclassified legal pad? Can you swear that you never sat down at home to draft an outline of a memo on classified issues because you were struck by an important insight at 10 p.m. and feared you might forget it, but didn't want to go all the way back to the office to write it down? that you never discussed an interesting issue with a colleague who had a clearance, but probably no real need to know? Or that you never scribbled your randomly generated 18-character computer password on a Post-it because you just could not seem to commit it to memory, no matter how hard you tried? If they're being honest, most people with security clearances will start looking a little red in the face. I remember a particularly surreal period during my stint at the Defense Department. When the first WikiLeaks cables became public, every media outlet in the world began quoting from the leaked documents. At the Pentagon, however, we were all warned not to even read any of those stories quoting leaked documents, because classified documents remain classified, even if they're splashed all over the front page of the New York Times. Thus, anyone who read media quotes from any leaked classified documents above his or her clearance level was accessing unauthorized information. Even those who had clearances higher than those needed to see any secret cables, most of which were at the time easily accessible on classified networks to anyone with a secret-level clearance, were forbidden from reading the media reports online, because if the news reports did contain any classified information, looking at them would constitute the unauthorized downloading of classified material onto unclassified government or private computers. This was a head-scratcher, particularly for anyone charged with dealing in any way with the media or the public. It forced the frequent use of bizarre circumlocutions to avoid accidentally messing up. If it is the case that classified information is contained in a Washington Post article, a fact I can neither confirm nor deny, that would be a security breach, and we certainly wish people would not read or discuss any such material that might or might not be genuine and might or might not be classified. As I noted earlier, some classified material obviously should be kept secret. Even the most ardent WikiLeaks supporter might accept that launch codes for U.S. nuclear weapons don't belong in the public domain, and the claim that we need to protect intelligence sources and methods isn't a frivolous one. Some of the intelligence the United States collects comes from individuals who pass information at great personal risk. Even when the information itself has little value to the United States, revealing that we have it can lead foreign organizations to identify our source, sometimes with lethal consequences. The problem, of course, is that from the outside, there's no way for a reporter or a citizen to know for sure. Is access restricted because it contains information that, if revealed, could truly harm the nation? Or is access restricted to cover up crime, fraud, or stupidity, or to make an uninteresting issue seem more important, or help a mid-level bureaucrat gain status? Chapter 6. Future Warfare. The murkiness surrounding war and the military isn't likely to dissipate. If anything, many just-around-the-corner technologies and trends are likely to increase the perceived military benefits of secrecy and further erode the lines between the world of war and the world of peace. It would take many books to describe all these trends, but consider just a few. Our increasing global reliance on the internet, advances in robotics, and the emergence of autonomous weapon systems, and the conjunction of precision weapons, bioengineering, and mass data collection, along with easily accessible tools for analyzing all that data, such as facial recognition programs. Consider also the evolution of what the military calls non-lethal weapons, technologies designed to incapacitate or control without killing. War in cyberspace. In suburban Maryland, hundreds of young men and women sit at computer terminals. They're cyber warriors, assigned to the military's newest combatant command, Cyber Command, or CyberCom, which is conveniently located in the same compound as the National Security Agency. CyberCom's task: protect America's internet infrastructure from all enemies, whether they be teenage hackers in Romania, Chinese government spies, or Islamic terrorists. If necessary, America's cyber warriors can go on the offensive, monitoring, disrupting, or destroying the cyber capabilities of others. Most of these young American cyber warriors have never heard a gun fired in anger. Many have never left the United States. They're trained in information technology, not in hand-to-hand combat. Yet the lines of code they produce have the potential to disable Russian websites, sow confusion within ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or even, according to press reports, damage centrifuges in Iran. It goes beyond computer code. One summer day a few years back, I visited a small, unmarked office building in an anonymous Maryland strip mall. Inside, the rooms were always kept dimly lit. For security reasons, the shades were always kept down and the windows were made of special glass, designed to foil electronic eavesdropping. The men and women who worked in these dim rooms were pleased to have a visitor from Mission Control, as someone jokingly called the Pentagon. They were glad to show off their clever technological tricks. I can't tell you what any of those tricks are. They're the most secret kind of secret, since if any bad guys came to know about them, they wouldn't work anymore. But just imagine. Imagine the things you think you already know the NSA can do thanks to Edward Snowden and press reports and multiply that. Imagine we had the ability to take technologies our adversaries trust and turn them to our own uses. That's the sort of thing Cybercom and a handful of other small Defense Department and intelligence organizations exist to do. It's not just about protecting email and financial software or monitoring websites used by U.S. adversaries. Some of it's even more sophisticated and surprising. But in a world in which more and more things, from our alarm clocks and our cars to our home security systems and cell phones, are or can be connected to the internet, more and more things can also be manipulated and controlled from afar. You can bet American adversaries are developing similar technologies to use against us, too. We assume that war involves physical violence. For this reason, military recruitment and training still emphasize physical strength and fitness. But today's military is also preparing for a possible future in which battles take place mainly in cyberspace, and winning or losing may have little or nothing to do with threats to life, limb, or property. Cyber battles will most likely be about information and control. Who will have access to sensitive health, personal, and financial information about individuals? Individuals who may, in some cases, make key individuals vulnerable to blackmail. Who will be able to control the machinery of daily life? The servers relied upon by the Pentagon and the New York Stock Exchange, the computers that keep our cars' brakes from activating at the wrong time, the software that runs our household computers. We might have decided to view cybersecurity as a purely civilian issue and conceptualized both current and future cyber attacks as criminal matters. But as with humanitarian assistance, rule of law programs, strategic communication, and so much else, the military has jumped in to fill the vacuum created by squabbling and under-resourced civilian agencies. Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, both of which are under the command of the same four-star military officer, have become America's primary cyber offense and defense agencies. Technically, the Department of Homeland Security is the lead agency for defending U.S. cyber infrastructure, but budget figures tell a different story. The 2016 budget request for DoD's cybersecurity activities, not including those carried out by the NSA, which has a separate classified budget, was over $5 billion, while Homeland Security's 2016 cyber budget request was just $1.4 billion. The emerging era of cyber war also creates new legal puzzles. If cyber attacks can be a form of warfare, what law should apply? International law on this question remains unsettled, but the government has already staked out a position. Cyber operations are subject to the law of armed conflict, and any cyber attacks that cause injury, death, or significant destruction could be considered armed attacks for legal purposes, triggering, among other things, a legal right to retaliate using conventional armed force. But this still leaves numerous unanswered questions. In the real world, distinguishing between civilians and combatants and civilian versus military infrastructure is hard enough. In the cyber world, it can be nearly impossible. The individualization of warfare. If we have traditionally conceived of war as violent, we have also traditionally tended to think of it as impersonal. As we have seen, however, improved surveillance technologies and precision targeting technologies have already begun to individualize warfare, primarily through targeted drone strikes. In the future, this trend will continue. More and more, we will see highly individualized attacks on specific individuals, in addition to, or in place of, impersonal assaults on enemy forces. This, too, will further blur the boundaries around war. Consider the world of big data and the world of bioscience. On the internet, more and more data is available about more and more people. Governments keep census data online. Banks keep financial data. Hospitals keep health data. Amazon.com keeps purchasing data. Social media sites keep our photos, videos, and personal musings. Data from cell phone cameras and security cameras is stored in the cloud. Add in rapidly improving facial and voice recognition software and rapidly advancing data analysis technologies, and it will soon be possible, and probably quite cheap, to build up detailed dossiers on half the people on Earth. As former Air Force Deputy Judge Advocate General Charles Dunlap notes in a recent article on what he calls the hyper-personalization of war, these capabilities are rapidly being militarized. In the not-too-distant future, the U.S. military, and likely other militaries, will be able to launch swarms of drones equipped with facial recognition software to roam battlefields looking for very specific members of an enemy's force. In the bioscience world, breakthroughs in our understanding of genetics are opening up the possibility of personalized medicine. Cancer treatments tailored to a specific person's genetic code, for instance. But the same discoveries that may soon allow doctors to tailor life-saving treatments to the needs of specific individuals may also allow the development of DNA-linked bioweapons, a virus designed to disable or kill only a specific individual. In some ways, the individualization of warfare may be a good thing. Targeted killings may be troublingly intimate, but they are surely better than indiscriminate killings. The law of war obligates parties to a conflict to avoid the intentional targeting of civilians and take all reasonable measures to avoid causing incidental civilian deaths. And the technologies that enable the individualization of warfare represent significant leaps forward in our ability to ensure that wars kill as few people as possible. Compared to the firebombing of Dresden or the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima, weapons capable of killing only specific individuals seem like a moral advance. Wouldn't it be nice if we could spare frightened young conscripts and kill only their bloodthirsty leaders? Or target only terrorist masterminds and the architects of genocidal campaigns, sparing those with lesser culpability and influence? Indeed, the individualization of warfare raises the possibility that warfare itself will be utterly transformed, becoming, as Harvard Law School's Gabriella Bloom suggests, more like policing, with its focus on individual harms, individual victims, and individual culpability. When individual malefactors can be reliably taken off the field, there's no reason to send hundreds of thousands of soldiers off to fight their counterparts in foreign lands. As warfare becomes more individualized, it may also become possible to add to warfare some of the due process protections common in law enforcement. We take it for granted that soldiers can't be expected to prove probable cause or obtain warrants from a judge before taking prisoners on a battlefield, much less provide evidence that proves a suspected combatant's enemy status beyond a reasonable doubt before using lethal force. In the context of, say, the invasion of Normandy, it makes perfect sense to accept a shoot-first, ask-questions-later standard. But why couldn't we have a different standard for different types of battlefields? In the context of targeted drone strikes, for instance, those we target have often been on kill lists for weeks or even years before the opportunity to kill them arises. In such a context, a modified judicial or quasi-judicial inquiry couldn't get in the way. On the contrary, greater due process could offer needed legitimacy. The individualization of warfare thus has the potential to bring war more in line with core human rights norms. Today, individualized killing technologies are still the prerogative of only the wealthiest and most technologically advanced states. But this will change. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other malignant non-state actors are already attuned to the emerging possibilities of personalized warfare. In 2007, for instance, terrorist sympathizers hacked into the email and telephone records of Danish soldiers serving in Afghanistan and used the information to harass and intimidate service members' families. More recently, an Islamic State website posted the names and home addresses of selected U.S. military personnel and their families in March 2015, urging our brothers in America to take the final step of killing them. Drone technologies and facial recognition technologies are commercially available already and will become steadily more sophisticated. Bioscience information, techniques, and materials also will become increasingly available to individuals and small groups. Even if we believe our own government will use these technologies responsibly, not a foregone conclusion, there's little reason to imagine others will do so. The individualization of warfare also raises some dismaying Orwellian possibilities. Andrew Hessel, Mark Goodman, and Stephen Kotler noted in a 2012 Atlantic article that DNA-linked bioweapons may usher in a future in which politicians, celebrities, leaders of industry, just about anyone really, could be vulnerable to attack by disease. Some attacks might be geared towards sowing disruption. Imagine a targeted bioweapon that could dramatically degrade cognitive functioning. Even if fatal, Hessel, Goodman, and Kotler argue, many such attacks could go undetected, mistaken for death by natural causes. Many others would be difficult to pin on a suspect, especially given the passage of time between exposure and the appearance of symptoms. Writing in the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes famously asserted that humanity's original state of nature must have been a war of all against all. The growing individualization of warfare suggests that this may be our all-too-real future, as well as our imagined past. Killer robots. Or perhaps future wars won't involve humans at all. Perhaps we will leave war to the robots. Today, the overwhelming majority of even our most advanced weapons technologies still require humans in the loop. There are a few relatively minor exceptions. Some missile defense systems are programmed to fire immediately if an incoming missile fits certain preset parameters, for instance. Since once an incoming missile is detected, it may impact in seconds, with too little time for a human to decide how to respond. But these situations are exceptional. For the most part, humans still make the important calls. Predator drones can't decide for themselves whom to kill. It takes a human being, often dozens of human beings in a complex multi-agency command chain, to decide that it's both legal and wise to launch missiles at a given target. In the not-so-distant future, this could change. Imagine robots programmed not only to detect and disarm roadside bombs, but to track and fire upon individuals concealing or emplacing IEDs. Or imagine an unmanned vehicle that can fire missiles when a computer determines that a given individual is behaving like a combatant, based on a pre-programmed set of criteria. Or imagine tiny, insect-sized nano-drones that operate in combat clouds, or swarms, remaining in constant real-time communication with one another and instantly modifying their flight paths and making decisions about targeting based not on human intervention, but on software instructions. Advances in artificial intelligence make this a real possibility. And the fact that other states, including some U.S. adversaries, are pursuing research into such weapon systems means that the United States may have to do the same, for purely defensive purposes. Human reaction time won't be able to keep pace with machine reaction time. A growing number of ethicists and rights advocates are troubled by this. Indeed, some are calling for a global ban on the development, production, and use of fully autonomous weapon systems, which are, according to Human Rights Watch, also, and rather conveniently, known as killer robots. The term does tend to have a chilling effect even upon those harboring a soft spot for R2-D2 and WALL-E. I'm less concerned, however, not because I'm fond of killer robots, but because I'm inclined to think ethicists and rights advocates are far too generous in their assumptions about human beings. Their core concern relates to military research into weapon systems that are fully autonomous, meaning that they can select and engage targets without human intervention. According to the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, this is troubling because, first, such killer robots might not have the ability to abide by the legal obligation to distinguish between combatants and civilians, and second, allowing life or death decisions to be made by machines crosses a fundamental moral line and jeopardizes fundamental principles of human dignity. Neither of these arguments persuades me. Granted, the thought of a robot firing indiscriminately into a crowd is dismaying, as is the thought of a rogue robot, sparks flying from every rusting joint, going berserk and turning its futuristic superweapons upon its own side. But setting science fiction aside, real-life computers have an excellent track record. When was the last time Siri staged a rebellion and began to systematically delete all your favorite videos just to mess with you? When was the last time a passenger plane's autopilot system got depressed and decided to plow into a mountain, notwithstanding human entreaties to remain airborne? Computers may be far better than human beings at complying with international humanitarian law. After all, we humans are fragile and panicky creatures, easily flustered by the fog of war. Our eyes face only one direction. Our ears register only certain frequencies. Our brains can process only so much information at a time. Loud noises make us jump, and fear floods our bodies with powerful chemicals that can temporarily distort our perceptions and judgment. As a result, we make mistakes in war, and we make them all the time. We misjudge distances, we forget instructions, we misconstrue gestures. We mistake cameras for weapons, shepherds for soldiers, friends for enemies, schools for barracks, and wedding parties for terrorist convoys. In fact, we humans have historically been quite bad at distinguishing between combatants and civilians, even in traditional conflicts between the militaries of opposing states. Even when we manage to correctly distinguish between civilians and combatants, we often make risk-averse calculations about necessity and proportionality, preferring dead civilians to dead comrades. If the U.S. conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan produced a surfeit of dead and mangled civilians, it's not because of killer robots. It's because of fallible human decision-making. Computers, in contrast, are excellent in crisis and combat situations. They don't get mad, they don't get scared, and they don't act out of sentimentality. They're exceptionally good at processing vast amounts of information in a short time and rapidly applying appropriate decision rules. Missile approaching, with impact projected in 19 seconds? For humans, that's not much time, but 19 seconds is an eon for a computer. Computers aren't perfect, but they're a good deal less flawed than those of us cursed with organic circuitry. We assure ourselves that we humans have special qualities no machine can replicate. We have judgment and intuition, for instance. Maybe, but computers often seem to have better judgment. This has already been demonstrated in dozens of different domains, from aviation to anesthesiology. Computers turn out to be better than humans at distinguishing between genuine and faked expressions of pain. Google's driverless cars fare better at avoiding accidents than cars controlled by humans. Given a choice between relying on a human to comply with international humanitarian law and relying on a well-designed, well-programmed robot, I'd take my chances with the killer robot any day. Opponents of autonomous weapons ask whether there's a legal and ethical obligation to refrain from letting machines make decisions about who should live and who should die. If it turns out, as it may, that machines are better than people at applying the principles of international humanitarian law, we may end up having to ask an entirely different question. Might there be a legal and ethical obligation to use killer robots in lieu of killer humans? Confronted with arguments about the technological superiority of computers over human brains, those opposed to the development of autonomous weapons systems argue that such consequentialist reasoning is insufficient. Ultimately, as a 2014 joint report by Human Rights Watch and Harvard's International Human Rights Clinic argues, it would simply be morally wrong to give machines the power to decide who lives and who dies. As inanimate machines, fully autonomous weapons could truly comprehend neither the value of individual life nor the significance of its loss. Allowing them to make determinations to take life away would thus conflict with the principle of human dignity. I suppose the idea is that any self-respecting person would naturally prefer death at the hands of a fellow member of the human species, someone capable of feeling compassion and mercy, to death inflicted by a cold, unfeeling machine. But death is death, and I don't imagine it gives the dying any consolation to know their human killer is capable of feeling bad about the whole affair. We shouldn't romanticize our own species. We humans are capable of mercy and compassion, but we also have a remarkable propensity for violence and cruelty. We're a species that kills for pleasure. Every year, more than 500,000 people around the globe die as a result of intentional violence, and many more are injured, starved, or deliberately deprived of shelter, medicine, or other essentials. In the United States alone, more than 14,000 people are murdered each year, and many more are the victims of other violent crimes. Humans, not robots, came up with such ingenious ideas as torture and death by crucifixion. Humans, not robots, came up with the idea of firebombing Dresden and Tokyo. Humans, not robots, planned the Holocaust and the Rwandan genocide. Plug in the right lines of code, and robots will dutifully abide by the laws of armed conflict to the best of their technological ability. In this sense, killer robots may be capable of behaving far more humanely than we might assume. But the flip side is also true. Humans can behave far more like machines than we generally assume. In the 1960s, experiments by Yale psychologist Stanley Milgram demonstrated the fearful ease with which ordinary humans could be persuaded to inflict pain on complete strangers. Since then, other psychologists have refined and extended his work. If you want to program an ordinary human being to participate in genocide, both history and social psychology suggest that it's not much more difficult than creating a new iPhone app. Admittedly, I'm assuming we'll have robots that obey the instructions we humans give them. Many of the alarmist scenarios involving autonomous weapons systems make the opposite assumption, however, envisioning intelligent, autonomous robots that decide to override the code that created them and turn upon us all. But when the robots go rogue, when lust for blood, money, or power begins to guide their actions, they'll have ceased to be robots in any meaningful sense. They'll finally be able to pass the Turing test. For all intents and purposes, they will have become humans. And it's humans we've had reason to fear all along. Non-lethal weapons. If we fought a war with weapons that did no permanent physical harm to our enemies, would they still be weapons? And would it still be a war? The advent of cyber war forces us to ask this question, but similar questions also arise when we consider advances in non-lethal weapons. The military is already experimenting with a number of technologies that can incapacitate or control enemies without causing injury or death. For instance, there's the active denial technology, which can shoot a focused beam of radio frequency millimeter waves at a frequency of 95 gigahertz toward a specific area. Traveling at the speed of light, the millimeter wave-directed energy engages the subject, penetrating the skin to a depth of only about 1/64th of an inch, or the equivalent of 3 sheets of paper, asserts a Defense Department fact sheet. 3 painful sheets of paper. Anyone caught in the beam will feel a sudden searing heat all over his or her body, making further forward movement impossible. One's natural instinct will be to move out of range. Once out of the beam, the sensation of unbearable heat immediately ceases, with no permanent ill effects, not even a bruise or burn. The value of such technology to the military is obvious. As the DoD fact sheet explains, active denial technology can be used for both force application and force protection missions. Applications include crowd control, patrol and convoy protection, perimeter security, and other defensive and offensive operations from both fixed-site or mobile platforms. Non-lethal directed energy weapons using active denial technology have the potential to provide non-lethal effects at distances up to and beyond small arms range, providing U.S. military forces with additional time and space to assess the intent of potential adversaries. Imagine, for instance, U.S. troops on patrol in an area that has seen multiple insurgent ambushes. Suddenly, a figure bursts out of an alleyway and races toward the patrol vehicles. Troops have only a split second to decide how to react. Is the figure a local teen running from an angry parent, or a suicide bomber who will detonate his vest as soon as he's close enough? Soldiers armed only with lethal weapons will tend to shoot first and ask questions later, but soldiers equipped with non-lethal directed energy weapons can stop the figure before he gets close enough to cause harm and let him go if he poses no threat. Similarly, improved flashbang grenades can temporarily disorient adversaries, using light and sound to create transient blindness and deafness. The new flashbang grenades can be thrown by hand, and another variant can be fired through existing mortar tubes from a distance of up to a kilometer. In the future, these non-lethal mortar rounds may also paint those caught near detonations with infrared or ultraviolet ink, invisible to the naked eye, but easily detected by U.S. troops trying to track enemies escaping through crowded city streets. Other emerging technologies fire lasers that cause temporary blindness, or high-powered radio waves that can cause vehicle engines to stall. As with technologies that enable the individualization of warfare, these non-lethal weapons have the potential to make warfare less bloody. Enemies can be incapacitated, disarmed, and detained instead of killed, and the failure to distinguish accurately between civilians and combatants will do no permanent harm. But here, too, the evolution and expansion of warfare raises distinctly Orwellian possibilities. Imagine the development of non-lethal DNA-linked bioweapons that cause hallucinations or crippling schizophrenia symptoms, aimed at political, economic, or military leaders, for instance. Or imagine linking non-lethal weapons to individualization technologies and distance warfare technologies in other ways. A world in which swarms of miniaturized drones with facial recognition software can seek out and incapacitate specific individuals in a crowd will be a world in which suicide bombers can be stopped in their tracks. But also a world in which repressive governments can exercise near-total control over dissenters. It will be a world in which lines between the worlds of war and peace will no longer exist. It will be a brave new world for sure. Chapter 7. What's an army for? It's raining in the Kuwaiti desert. It's not supposed to rain in the desert, and the downpour is snarling traffic, flooding barracks, and leaving military vehicles sodden and afloat at Camp Arifjan, the forward headquarters of U.S. Army Central and Kuwait's largest American base.
I guess no one thought it was important to have good drainage in the middle of the desert,
Colonel William Eubank tells me glumly. Eubank, the commander of Kuwait's area support group, is the man in charge of keeping everything up and running at Arifjan and nearby Camp Buring, which together housed some 12,000 soldiers when I visited in 2014, the largest concentration of deployed army personnel outside of Afghanistan, Germany, and South Korea. It's no easy task, particularly when many of those soldiers seem to have no clear idea what they're doing in Kuwait. So what are you guys doing here? I ask the young private behind me in line at Camp Arifjan's spacious Starbucks. I mean, in Kuwait. What's your mission here? He offers a sheepish shrug. Got me, ma'am. That's above my pay grade. I'm just trying to stay dry.
Ours not to wonder why. Ours but to try and stay dry,
quips the lieutenant in front of him, carefully maneuvering a lid onto his overflowing cup of caramel latte. In an age in which even the lowest-ranking soldiers are expected to be able to understand and articulate U.S. strategic goals, got me is, of course, the wrong answer to journalistic queries. It has the distinct virtue of honesty, however. As the boundaries of war grow ever blurrier and the tasks we assign to the military grow ever more varied, the U.S. military is increasingly struggling to understand and articulate its own role. For the Army, America's largest service and the historical center of America's military, the problem is particularly acute. The Iraq War is over, the war in Afghanistan is winding down, and Washington's budget cutters are sharpening their knives. In a world of cyber operations, pirates, humanitarian missions, and high-tech unmanned aerial vehicles, the Army is struggling to define and defend its role and mission. Why should the United States Army keep roughly 12,000 soldiers stationed in peacetime Kuwait? And more broadly, why does a nation so seemingly determined to avoid another land war need a large standing army with troops deployed all over the world? Won't the conflicts of the future be better suited to the Navy and Air Force, with their drones and computers and other technologically advanced toys, than to the Army's 540,000 grunts, with their tanks, rucksacks, and muddy boots? Former Army Chief of Staff General Raymond Odierno thought he could answer those questions, and whether they knew it or not, the 12,000 soldiers stationed in Kuwait were part of his ambitious effort to reimagine the Army of the future. Odierno, who served as Army Chief of Staff from 2011 until his retirement in 2015, believed that the Army's future lies in regionally aligned forces. Army units, from whole divisions down to the small unit level, that will have long-term relationships with particular geographic combatant commands, and perhaps even with particular sub-regions and countries, such as the Gulf States or Kuwait. These regionally aligned forces, or RAF, since the Army instinctively acronymizes everything from meals to weapons, will receive significant region-specific linguistic and cultural training, making them more effective across the entire spectrum of conflict and better able to stay well to the left of boom. More culturally attuned soldiers will be better equipped to identify brewing conflicts before they get out of hand, enabling more timely and effective shaping and deterrence activities. Shaping means activities designed to make conditions favorable for U.S. military success, and can include efforts to influence local populations, establish friendly relations with host populations and local leaders, strengthen military-to-military cooperation, and the like. If conflict breaks out, soldiers with a deeper understanding of local cultural dynamics will have both a better understanding of the enemy and a greater ability to work effectively with the host population, making tactical, operational, and strategic success more likely. Before the most recent set of conflicts, wrote Odierno in March 2012, it was generally believed that cultural awareness was only required in select army units, such as special forces. Most units in the general purpose force were deployed without regard to building up regional expertise. Thus, a brigade could find itself in Korea 1 year, Iraq 2 years after that, Germany a few years later, and then in Afghanistan. Implicit in this force management system was the assumption that military skills exist in a realm outside of culture, and local populations are mostly just background noise. Like many others in his generation of senior officers, Odierno, who spent 4 years commanding troops in Iraq, learned the hard way that military skills don't exist in a cultural vacuum. "We went in there with a complete misunderstanding, regionally and inside Iraq, of what was going on," he told me, shaking his head at the memory. "I don't ever want that to happen again." The U.S.-led military coalition easily defeated Saddam Hussein's conventional forces, but lack of cultural, linguistic, and political understanding consistently hampered efforts to restore stability and comprehend the insurgency's roots, structure, and asymmetrical tactics. Meanwhile, many American successes in Iraq hinged on painstaking efforts to build up cultural knowledge. Mapping clan and family relationships turned out to be key to identify Saddam Hussein's hiding place, for instance. The regionally aligned forces concept represents the Army's effort to lock in the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan on a global scale. We don't know which threats will prove most serious in the future, and we don't know which part of the world will give rise to the most serious threats. So to leaders like Odierno and his successors, the best way to hedge against risk is for the Army to align forces to every geographic region. No one can be an expert on every region, speak every language, or develop strong personal ties with people in every country. But aligning Army units with each geographic combatant command increases the odds that the United States will have at least some knowledgeable forces able to predict, prevent, and respond effectively to future crises. The concept of regionally aligned forces represents an ambitious effort to rethink the Army's role and mission in the uncertain, globalized, post-9/11 world. It's an effort to take a large, clumsy industrial behemoth and turn it into an agile, regionally engaged, globally responsive, and culturally sophisticated force, one that's more Mao than Bismarck and more T.E. Lawrence than George Patton. It's also smart marketing for the Army at a moment when budget cutters in the executive branch and on the Hill are sharpening their knives. There are many people that believe that through technology advancement, we can solve all of the issues of warfare, Odierno commented. I absolutely reject that concept. Human interaction in a complex environment is key to our success in the future. The United States needs a force that is skilled in understanding the physical, cognitive, the information, cultural, and social environments we have to operate in the future. There's a not-so-subtle subtext here. The Navy and Air Force can brag all they want about their technologically sophisticated systems, but you can't build human relationships from the deck of an aircraft carrier or the simulated cockpit of a Predator drone. Building relationships on a global scale requires putting human beings on the ground in regions all over the world, and only the Army has the manpower to do this. Nevertheless, formidable obstacles stand in the way of the Army's vision for regionally aligned forces. Some of those obstacles are external. To succeed with their plans for regional alignment, Army leaders will need buy-in from the other services, the State Department, the White House, and the Hill. And getting that is far from a foregone conclusion. But many of the obstacles are internal. The Army may not resemble an aircraft carrier in most ways, but it shares an aircraft carrier's inability to make rapid turns. Any effort to rethink long-standing practices generates anxiety, confusion, and bureaucratic resistance. It's like the old joke. How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Senior Army leaders know that if the Army wants to remain relevant and useful, it needs to change. But does it want to change? We're not in Kansas anymore. Before the regionally aligned forces concept was developed, recalls Odierno, geographic combatant commanders would complain about the unpredictability and inefficiency of the military's Byzantine global force management system. Combatant commanders never knew precisely what forces would be made available to them and couldn't count on being able to access the capabilities they considered most useful in their region. The problem was particularly acute for AFRICOM, the neglected stepchild of the geographic combatant commands. With no assigned forces, the command often found itself last in line when troops were allocated. But with the advent of regionally aligned forces, declared the Army Times in June 2013, everything you know about deployments is about to change. For smaller geographic combatant commands, such as AFRICOM, RAF would create a reliable source of Army troops that could be drawn upon at will by the combatant commander. For individual soldiers, promised the Army Times, the immersion in language, regional expertise, and culture training will be the big difference. Indeed, units assigned to the new deployment model will quickly find themselves on the cutting edge of the human dimension doctrine. The Army's efforts to operationalize the RAF concept started small and in the middle of Kansas. At Fort Riley, the 1st Infantry Division's 2nd Brigade Combat Team, BCT, the Dagger Brigade, was designated the Army's first regionally aligned brigade in spring 2012. The brigade and its several thousand soldiers aligned with Africa Command, the smallest and youngest of the military's geographic combatant commands, COCOMs. In Kansas, Fort Riley's Dagger Brigade struggled to figure out what it meant to be regionally aligned to AFRICOM. With no template for how to increase their sociocultural knowledge, brigade leaders got creative, scrounging up African students and faculty experts on Africa at nearby Kansas State University. With their help, the brigade developed a training course for troops preparing to deploy. The training course was short, just a week long, but the brigade's regional deployments were also short. The brigade as a whole remained at Fort Riley, sending small units off for days or weeks at a time to train or conduct exercises with African partner forces. 24 soldiers from Fort Riley helped train Mali-bound UN peacekeeping troops in Niger. Several hundred Dagger Brigade soldiers conducted exercises in South Africa. 2 Fort Riley snipers conducted a short-term mission in Burundi, and so on. It wasn't immersion, but the Army deemed this initial regional alignment experiment a success and stepped up efforts to align forces to other geographic combatant commands. The 7th Infantry Division's 3-2 Striker Brigade Combat Team has been aligned to the Pacific Command, for instance, while the 1st Armored Division has been aligned to Central Command. And this, Army officials say, is just the beginning. The question of what wars and where can be worked out at their leisure. Outside Army circles, the regionally aligned forces concept generated little interest beyond a few media mentions. Most were respectful, if slightly bemused. U.S. Army hones anti-terror strategy for Africa in Kansas, the New York Times reported. On the left, however, RAF has been viewed as further evidence of the United States' sinister, hegemonic ambitions. An article by Nick Terse in The Nation charged that AFRICOM releases information about only a fraction of its activities, preferring to keep most information about what it's doing and when and where secret. But, Terse continued, previously undisclosed U.S. Army Africa records reveal that in 2013, Fort Riley's Dagger Brigade took part in 128 separate activities in 28 African countries as part of the Army's regionally aligned forces effort. So much else remains in the shadows, Terse wrote, including, he suggests, U.S. training of coup plotters and war criminals. It remains to be seen just what else we don't know about U.S. Africa Command's exponentially expanding operations. On antiwar.com, A post by news editor Jason Ditz warned that General Raymond Odierno's regionally aligned forces plan gives the U.S. the ability to quickly deploy troops anywhere on the planet. With enough troops and enough countries involved, the question of what wars and where can be worked out at their leisure. Lieutenant General James Terry, the commander of U.S. Army Central, ARCENT, shakes his head at the notion that anyone could view RAF as a sign of growing U.S. bellicosity. After 12 years of war, he tells me, I don't wish another protracted conflict on my grandkids. If we get regionally aligned forces right, if we get the shaping right, we can hopefully help prevent another conflict. Odierno agrees. RAF, he says, is premised on the need to prevent conflicts. He has better reason than most to understand that war isn't an impersonal game of chess. Among the thousands of soldiers killed or grievously injured during the Iraq War was his son, Tony, who lost his left arm in 2004 when his vehicle was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. Still, it's not hard to understand why some might feel a flicker of unease when contemplating RAF. Even if it doesn't reflect hegemonic ambitions, the RAF concept, taken to its logical extreme, does suggest that senior Army officials view the entire globe as a potential battlefield. Most Americans think of peace as a time in which the military is more or less irrelevant, but military doctrine takes a different view. Recall that to the military, what most would call peace is merely phase zero, the first phase on the six-phase spectrum of conflict. In phase zero, a period without active conflict, the military's role is understood as shaping the character of possible future operations by building relationships, collecting information, and seeking to influence attitudes of local actors. It's always 5 o'clock somewhere, says the dedicated drinker. The RAF concept suggests that to General Odierno and other senior Army leaders, it's always phase zero somewhere. In fact, at any given time, it's phase zero almost everywhere. So why not have regionally aligned Army forces everywhere? In late 2013, Army officials launched a full-court press to publicize the regionally aligned forces concept. At the 2013 annual meeting of the Association of the United States Army, a nonprofit advocacy and research organization, senior Army officials offered multiple presentations on RAF, from a speech by General Odierno to panel discussions featuring numerous senior Army officials. Regionally aligned forces will ensure that the Army's prevent-shape-win strategy is operationalized, proclaimed a handout distributed at the meeting by Forcecom, the Army's manpower command. In the human domain, people-to-people relationships matter. Several years after Odierno first unveiled his vision for regionally aligned forces, however, it remains remarkably difficult to penetrate the cloud of jargon-laden rhetoric and pin down Army officials on what any of this really means. Oddly, the Army's day-to-day point person for the initial development of the regionally aligned forces construct wasn't a U.S. Army officer at all, but a British Army officer. After a stint at the U.S. Army War College, Colonel James Learmont found himself assigned to U.S. Army headquarters at the Pentagon as a British exchange officer, where he was handed the unenviable task of figuring out how to turn General Odierno's ambitious concept into a reality for the U.S. Army. In some ways, Learmont was the perfect man for the job. Every British Army officer has a bit of T.E. Lawrence in his DNA, and the British know a little something about both the seductions and perils of empire. Learmont's own military career brought him to Germany, Norway, Iraq, Australia, Bosnia, and Afghanistan, often working in close coordination with U.S. and other NATO forces. As a friendly outsider, he's seen the U.S. Army up close, in all its glory and with all its warts, and he's seen the distinct benefits of a U.S. Army that's better trained, more professional, and more culturally aware. What Learmont couldn't bring to the table, however, is an insider's understanding of the culture and bureaucracy of the U.S. Army itself. Yet if anything sabotages General Odierno's vision of RAF, it's most likely to be the tendency of any large bureaucracy to water down transformational concepts until they cease to have much real meaning. Sitting in Learmont's windowless Pentagon office one afternoon after my Kuwait trip, I explained that even after weeks of research and interviews, I'm still having trouble getting a handle on what RAF is and what it isn't. Everyone I speak to seems to have a different understanding of RAF, I tell Learmont. Some see it as an overdue transformation of the whole army. Some see it as a tool of imperialist intervention. And others see it, in the words of one former Pentagon official, as another giant army nothing burger. Also, I tell Learmont, no one seems able to offer clarity on which Army units are regionally aligned, which are not, and which are slated to be regionally aligned in the future. Learmont obviously gets these questions a lot. He sighs. One of the biggest problems we have is the straightforward education piece, he tells me. For one thing, he says, RAF isn't just for combat troops. RAF, he insists, encompasses the Army total force, including the active duty force, the Army Reserve, and the National Guard. And it includes headquarters elements and enablers, such as engineers, transportation and logistics units, and even organizations like the Army's Training and Doctrine Command, TRADOC, the whole kit and caboodle. Everything the Army's got, says Learmont, is in some way regionally aligned.